Welcome to Research at Texas A&M. The following podcast, Balance Sheet Crises, Causes and Consequences, is part of the Texas A&M Institute for Advanced Study Faculty Fellows Lecture Series. Dr. Vernon L. Smith holds joint appointments with the Arduous School of Business and Economics and the School of Law and helps operate the new Economic Institute at Chapman University. He was awarded the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for his groundbreaking work in experimental economics. As a 2012-2013 eminent scholar in TEOS, he has offered two lectures on economics.
Well, thank you very much. Wonderful concatenation of introductions. It's a really great pleasure to be here. I'm honored to be to speak at the inaugural year of the new Institute for Advanced Study, and I want to thank all of you for coming. And now, it was mentioned that I would tell you how to get out of this mess. No. My advice is there's no painful way out of a balance sheet recession. It doesn't exist. So the thing to do is avoid getting there in the first place. Okay? That's my advice. This work is based upon a book, a manuscript that Steve Gierstadt, my colleague at Chapman University, have been working on for about, we started following the Great Recession in 2007, and then we've had some papers along the way, including quite a long paper in the Wall Street Journal that early on that attracted quite a bit of interest. We had a lot of, we were getting hits for a week, I think, on that paper. And then gradually it has evolved into a manuscript that will be published by Cambridge University Press. So I'm going to give you an outline, a fairly detailed outline of what I'm going to do, and then I won't do a final wrap-up because I think this will serve to kind of indicate the outline, what it is I'm going to do. Now, it's going to be partly in the form of a series of propositions, okay? Now, proposition one is that the Great Recession is a household bank balance sheet crisis, and I'll describe kind of what that means and show you a couple of slides that I think that really brings that home. I've got dozens of slides, but you too, it's going to, I think, pretty well dramatize what this is all about. And then proposition two, and believe me, after we, Steve and I, kind of wrapped up most of our initial examination of the Great Recession, we thought that as we go back earlier, we would find that this was very unusual. Well, it was unusual only in its severity, because proposition two is that housing is the business cycle. Over and over again, housing is implicated. And we've looked at the last 14 recessions, which includes going back to the Great Depression. Balance sheets recessions are rare in the United States. And I'm going to show you a couple slides showing that the Great Recession was driven by a tripling of mortgage debt flow 2000 to 2006. And right after that, I'll show you a slide from the 1920s indicating that mortgage debt flow tripled from 1921 to 1926. Very similar, and we have data to suggest that that's really what set the stage for the major collapse that was known as the Depression. Proposition 3, how do you achieve escape momentum from recessions with many household and bank balance sheets damage? Well, not by monetary super ease. That's pretty widely recognized. But I'm going to show you some data to suggest that you don't do it by government deficit spending either. And the reason is the same as why monetary policy doesn't work. And I'll show you a few, some evidence to support that. And then I'm going to consider 3 responses, and remember, none of these are painless. A, bankruptcy and default. Now, people are very much afraid of this. They see that as part of the collapse and, in some sense, a cause of the collapse. But it's important to understand that bankruptcy and default, that's a process that repairs balance sheets. It reboots them. It's a healing process. It allows people to get started again, okay, and get out of negative equity. The question is whether you're going to do it quickly or rapidly. And then an alternative to that, allowing failures and maybe being creative and trying to minimize their damage but not getting in the way of them, is to protect incumbent creditors, investors from default. That's the Japanese model. It's the United States model. It's basically the European model. It's the too big to fail model. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then I want to, at the end, talk about, there's actually a lot of experiments around the world in balance sheet crises. Most of them are in small countries. Japan was not a small country. That's a big country, and I'll show you a slide for that. But these have happened many times in small countries. And the recovery process from those is remarkably similar. It comes through market depreciation of the currency. The market starts to depreciate that currency. It's not a decision. It needn't be a decision by a central government. In fact, I'm going to show you Finland, Thailand, and Argentina. Thailand and Argentina are interesting because there, the policymakers tried to prevent the collapse of the currency. And it wasn't until they let the currency go that you had jump-started a recovery. Okay, beginning with Proposition 1, the Great Recession is a household bank balance sheet crisis. Okay, and basically what a balance sheet crisis is a decline in house values against fixed mortgage debt that catapults households, many of them, into negative equity. And it's a bank balance sheet crisis also because the banks are holding the mortgages. So if the households are under stress and in negative equity, the banks are suffering from the same malady. Okay? Now, this slide, I think, I'm only going to show you 2 slides. This is a slide that kind of indicates how dramatic the collapse of value was against fixed debt and the great impact on equity and reducing equity. A little later, I'm going to show you a similar slide for, I think it's 4 recessions after the Second World War that we consider they weren't as serious. Some of them were pretty painful, but none of those you'll see in a parallel slide with this. None of them suffered anything like what we suffered in this collapse. And now notice here. Here is the total value of all single-family, multifamily enterprises in the United States, or households in the United States, okay? And here that starts out in 1997 at about $10.5 trillion. By the way, I think the important, one of the, see, the question is what triggers these? It's very hard to tell. But 1997, the inflation adjusted national price, median price of homes started up after declining for several years. A likely candidate for what helped jumpstart it was a very popular bipartisan bill. Bill Clinton upstaged the Republicans who were wanted to cut taxes. He says, I'm going to make it possible so you never have to pay a capital gains tax on your home. Never will you have to do that. Up to $500,000 of capital gains on a home will be, you can take to your bottom line and pay no taxes on it. Minimum holding period, 2 years. Can you do this more than once? Yeah, you can do it as many times as you want to. Whatever capital gain. Okay? I think it's very significant that that's 1997. Very popular. Everybody liked that. We have met the enemy. And he is us. Okay? How many of you remember Pogo, the cartoonist? Well, that's a famous line in Pogo. We have met the enemy and he's us. Well, okay, so here's the total value of home. And by the way, prices of inflation-adjusted prices of homes rose from 1997 to 2005, flattened out in 2006, and started down. Well, along with it, of course, the value of all homes is going up like this. And now here is debt. Starts at about $4 trillion. Here's the value of all homes at about 10.5. It follows pretty much in step. A little doesn't grow quite as fast. And equity is growing. Okay, equity is just the difference between the red line and the blue line. All right? Okay. Homes, the value of homes start to fall. They flatten, fall a little, and then start to really come down. Okay, here's debt continuing up in 2006. Continuing up not quite as fast in 2007, and then turns down ever so slightly. Okay, and then gradually starts a descent. Meantime, the value of homes are coming down, and it's all coming out of equity. As we say, leverage cuts both ways, and it's really deep when it's on the downside in terms of the damage it does. and then here's the recession. Started in the fourth quarter of 2007, and this is the official period of the recession, but as everyone now knows, that we're still kind of stuck in a low growth, very low growth, a subpar economy. Now notice here, from 1997 this is 2011, but when this expands up, things don't really start to turn around to 2012. But let's just look at it here as of the second quarter 2011. You see the value of all homes go from $10.5 trillion to about $14 trillion. Okay. Equity goes from $6 trillion to about $5.5 trillion. We've got essentially 15 years, and equity doesn't change over that whole period. It's basically people mortgaging the future to build all those homes. Okay? Essentially, that's why we're stuck with 23% of homes underwater. okay, now this gives you a sense of the structure of that impact on this comes from the Survey of Consumer Finances. The Federal Reserve Board does these every 3 years. So there's one in 2004, one in 2007, and one in 2010. And we're just looking here at the changes in median and mean income, and also, importantly, net worth. So you have 2004 to 7, you have no change in the median income, but an 8.5% increase in the mean. That means people above the middle are doing better than the ones below the middle in terms of income. What happened in 2007 to 2010? Median falls nearly 8%. It's going back to levels in the early 90s. Okay? And here's the mean following. All this is being given back. And the income's falling. But look at net worth change. The median from 2004 to 7 went up nearly 18%. The mean 13%. People below the median net worth were doing better than those above. All of those programs during that period, all those programs directed to helping people of modest means own a home and get rich owning a home, those programs were working. Okay? You can say they were working, and there's the evidence that they were working. And then comes 2007 to 10, and we have a whopping 39% drop in the median. Now you're going back, people aren't back in the early 90s. Okay, proposition two, housing is the business cycle. And we're going to look at the last, and I've got one slide that will show the last 14 recessions. And then I got a couple of slides on the Great Recession and the Depression that kind of indicates how the flow of credit was a comparison of those two periods with regard to the flow of credit. Now here is the last 14 recession shown shaded. And what we're plotting here is expenditures on single-family and multifamily homes. These are new constructions, new units, expenditures annually as a percentage of GDP, gross domestic product. Here's 19, 21, 22, 23, 24, huge increase in the construction spending for new single-family and multifamily homes. This is 25, it starts down on 26, 27, 28, 29. The stock market crash came in October of 1929 as an afterthought. The damage, we argue, had already been done. Banks, I don't have any charts, our book will cover this, but commercial banks in the 20s made predominantly about 85% of the loans, mortgage loans, were either either interest only or they were partially amortized. In either case, it means these are loans that are for 3 or 4 years. They're rolled over and they're being refinanced. Okay? Now, commercial banks were not nearly so large as a proportion of the total then as they are now, but I think that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on. Here's the decline and then the subsequent depression. And then notice here, now we don't count this because this is during the war there was great reduction in construction on homes, and then after the war that recovered, so we don't even count this. There was a transition, a wartime to peacetime transition in here. But here's then a recession preceded by the decline in housing. Here's another one. Now, that was delayed here. You see, in a sense, that's kind of a false positive, but the Korean War expenditures easily take up that slack. And government spending can take up the slack if you're not in a balance sheet recession, okay? It behaves normally. Here's another decline in a recession, Here's another false positive, but again, it's very easy to see what's the huge expansion in the Vietnam War of government spending accounts for that delay. And then here it comes down and we get the recession. And then here's a double dip. Here's a decline, and then there's a recovery. And then a decline again, and this is the famous double dip of 1980 and 81, 82. And here's, none here. There was no recession here. In fact, this period, and it was kind of an easy money period, there's good indications that that helped to continue and fuel the housing bubble. And here's this massive decline that foreshadowed the Great Recession. Now, you might think, well, gee, you always got a lot of lead time if you're following housing. Lots of lead time. Why aren't they experts? Why aren't they picking up on this? Why isn't this part of the standard kind of thing? Well, suppose you are Ben Bernanke, and you see that this problem is coming in 2004, and you're well aware this is coming along. And suppose you act then to intervene to prevent the Great Recession, then the bubble will break and you'll get blamed for it. You can argue all day that it would have been worse if all the evidence says it would have been worse if I hadn't have done this. Try selling that. Try selling that to the politicians. Try selling that to Congress. Try to sell that to the people. See, that's the paradox of policy, is that if you've got it figured out, you've got to watch out. It'll be interpreted as an error, and you'll be blamed for it, and you won't have your job. You'll be out of that job pretty fast. Okay. Now, these are four recessions between the Second World War and the Great Recession, and you'll notice here that there isn't, in none of them do we have a basic negative equity crunch. And there's some decline and everything, but the thing is, the housing market is never so saturated in any of these cases that you can't bring it back with easy money and lowering interest rates. So it tends to come back. But that control, we believe, was lost in the Great Depression. It was lost in the Great Recession. Okay, here's the flow of mortgage credit from 1970. To 2010, and here it's about tripling from 100 billion to around 300 right here. Notice we have, this is the exponential trend growth from 52. To 98, and kind of that's just kind of a reference to give you an idea here of kind of the excess flow you see, particularly in these two periods here. Well, we had a housing bubble that peaked in 1979. We had another one that peaked in 1989, and notice it's being driven by the inflow of credit. And of course, as all of you well remember, we had a really bad one here that peaked in 2005 and started down in 2006. Well, here's a similar slide from the 1920s and 30s. So notice here that in 21, the flow of mortgage funds was about $1 billion per year, and it grew, it tripled to $3 billion per year in 1926. Kind of levied out, stayed high. Now, new homes were being constructed and continued at a high level in 1927, 1928. The flow of mortgage funds, new home construction was starting to fall. It fell in 26, 27, 28, but the flow of mortgage funds continued. Where's that going to go? It's increasing leverage. There's no place else for it to go. So the flow of mortgage funds completely collapsed along with the housing market and the whole economy. You see in 29, 30, it bottomed out here in 1933. And look here, it's negative. The flow of mortgage funds is negative. It's been that for a long time after the Great Recession. As old loans are being paid off faster than new loans and mortgage markets loans are being created. Notice that the net flow of mortgage funds doesn't become positive till 1938. So it's negative here for all of these years. Bottomed down in 1933, the economy started to recover in 1934. Now, 1934, I lived on a farm. I was 7 years old with my parents. We lost the farm to the bank. Okay? I look back on that, good riddance. Good riddance. The bank lost money on it too, of course. They couldn't sell it for... Everybody's losing money on everything. Good riddance, because think how many people are in a home that's dropped in price. They maybe they bought it for $450,000. It's now worth $250,000. The bank has recognized they have a problem and lowered their payments. And how they lowered the payments? By lowering the principal? No. By lowering the rate of interest and stretching the loan for 15 to 30 years. So you're going to carry that ball of chain, that ball and chain into the future. Okay, you're still in negative equity. So that's why I look back and I thought that was good riddance. We got out of there. You get restarted. Those banks failed. And those assets were picked up. The system started to come back. It was very painful, because there was, in those days, you didn't have deposit insurance, and there's no doubt but what the Federal Reserve made a bunch of mistakes. But that's not the point. We don't see the primary cause of the Depression as coming from mistakes of the Federal Reserve. Okay, Proposition 3. How do you achieve escape momentum from recessions with large numbers of damaged household and bank balance sheets? And today about 22-23% of homeowners are in negative equity, and a lot more of them at the edge of that black hole, okay? Well, you don't do it with monetary expansion. Some inflation might help restore balance sheets, because it reduces the real value of debt. Okay, but monetary policy, it's inert. It's what Sir Dennis Robertson called pushing on a string, monetary policy. I'm pretty sure he's the original author of that in the 1930s or 40s. Not by government deficit spending. It fails for the same reason that monetary ease fails. Why? Too many what we call low, zero, or negative equity balance sheet tanks. The tanks are too low, and people are gradually refilling those tanks, you see. I sat in Alvin Hansen's class in the fall of 1952 at Harvard, Alvin Hansen was arguably the best known American Keynesian. Now, what I learned was, because of the liquidity trap, that monetary policy wouldn't work. I never knew what the liquidity trap was. It was just a name for the fact that monetary policy didn't work. Okay, that's what it was. They got a name for it, and it sounds like a theory. And you draw flat curves to show, you see. But it tells you nothing about what it was. In fact, I've revisited Keynes's general theory. He's a pretty smart guy. I was interested in see if he said anything about balance sheets. No, there's nothing in there. You know what? Balance sheets don't exist in macroeconomic models. They don't exist in the general equilibrium model. It's all about flows. And because it's all about flows, it's missing what it is that we're talking about here. But Alvin Hansen also said, but fiscal policy, deficit spending will work. What's the evidence? Well, he said, we didn't get out of the Depression until you had this buildup of war spending in the United States, 1940-41. That's still the one data point that everybody refers to. But what I realized when Steve and I were looking at the consequences of balance sheet recession, we realized, wait a minute, in 1940, there'd been 10 years of balance sheet repair. Come on, all kinds of banks failed. There were massive defaults and failure. The Homeowners Loan Corporation started in 1934 and shut down in 1940, bought nearly a million mortgages from homeowners, reset the principal at market value, and reissued them to the homeowners. That's balance sheet repair. Okay, all of that was being reinitialized. Well, when you have 10 years of that, will government spending work? Yeah, it'll work. Of course, it'll work anytime you don't have these balance sheet holes. Okay, that's our argument. Okay, let's consider now three recovery responses. The bankruptcy in default as a balance sheet repair reboot, and you need to think of it as a healing process. You're correcting, you're resetting balance sheets to get rid of this negative equity. Okay, when a company goes bankrupt, the question is, equity holders are often wiped out, bondholders take a haircut, and new owners can come in and take over that enterprise, put new capital in it, and it can get started again. Same thing with the bank. Okay. So if you did this for homeowners, you'd lower the payments to support market-based principal and balance if the borrower can pay. Otherwise, foreclose or short sell the house. That's getting rid of it. You know, as I say, good riddance. Better than the alternative we've been doing. Banks then recapitalize through private markets. Downsize as required. You zero out the equity. The bondholders take their hit. So in this process, only prepaid deposits are guaranteed, not the investors. And that's essentially the model the FDIC uses. Now, not so much the homeowners, because Sheila Bair worked on that, and they did what they could. Sheila Bair is one of the two heroines of this whole mess. The other one is Brooksley Bourne. Brooksley Bourne was chairman of the CFTC, a Bill Clinton appointment. And she wanted in 1998 to revisit the exempt status of derivatives. And the boys shouted her down. Okay, Greenspan, Rubin, and whoever was the chairman of the SEC then. And they got legislation to block the CFTC from getting involved in the exempt status of derivatives. She knew what she was talking about because she had been a litigant in bankruptcy cases, and she saw how much damage derivatives that had not been collateralized and required to be collateralized could do. And so anyway, Sheila Bair stood in there for 5 years, and she presided over about 380 bank failures over at the FDIC. Read her book, Bull by the Horns. It is on the ground treatment of a lot of the issues that Steve and I have been uncovering, except that this has a nuts and bolts on the ground view of it. And also it gives you an inside view of the conflict among the regulators and how they couldn't get their act together and the disagreement. Well, now, why is this important? Well, new capital now can directly flow into new activities undiluted by past capital claimants whose investment failed. You see, if the incumbent investors take their hit and you zero things out, now new investors gets all of the return from the recovery. See, these guys took their risk, they lost, let them eat it, and then the system. That's the key to understanding why it's important to do this if you're going to have recovery, and why there's a problem if you don't, because you're going to dilute that investment with trying to give some return. The political process always will support incumbent investors, okay? Because they're the ones that vote. They're the ones that make contributions to political parties. They're the ones that are on the line. They're the ones that are squeaking. And you're going to listen to them. All of the new investors that are going to come in, and there'll be many of those same investors after they take their hit, where else are they going to go? Okay? It'll be the new investors coming in that get the return now from the recovery, and that's what really gives the whole give a recovery oomph. And you see, it removes balance sheet barriers to lending, borrower, and the resumption of normal demand. By the way, that's the Swedes did this in their crisis in the early 90s. They just took over the banks. They only made one mistake. They did bail out the bondholders. You shouldn't bail out any of them. The equity guys all took the hit. Because if there's any bailout, then some of the potential return, you see, the recovery is going to be diluted by the claims of these guys that escaped the hit. So that's to me, that's the bottom line. Okay. I'm using a fair amount of time here. If you protect creditors and investors from default, you carry bank mortgages at face value. Okay, you don't have to take a hit on the profit sheet if you can kick it down the road, okay? Borrower makes full payment if at all feasible. If not, lower payments by lengthening the loan term, lowering interest, not the loan balance. Otherwise, foreclose short. That's kind of the model we've used. And so, take Bank of America and Citibank, which are among the very largest banks, and we saved them from bankruptcy, okay? Today, those two, their shares have been coming back. In fact, they're hitting new highs, but they're still selling only 60-7% of the book value. They're selling at a big discount. Why don't investors trust the books? They're not persuaded that the books are really telling anything about the true value. Okay? If you look at Wells Fargo Corporation, they were part of the bailout, but they needed like a hole in the head. They didn't need the TARP funds. But if you read Sheila Bell's book, it was all about camouflaging those who did need to get bailed out, okay? They wanted to create a cover for that. And that's documented in detail. And I figure both Bank of America and Citibank shares, since there's attrition here, those are the guys who got bailed out and needed it, shares, this is probably overvalued. If you discount, in other words, if you figure these guys can't fail, then they're going to, shares are going to sell for more than they otherwise would. Okay, so anyway, in this world, the recovery's postponed. And you see, depression clock time in 2012 is 1934 in the depression. GNP grew 7% in 1934. The economy was coming back. Now, it's true the slump was a lot worse, but it's not clear we haven't just stretched that pain out. The jury is still out on that one, okay? Can we expect recovery over the next 3 years? Well, we know we don't have any experience with this. Massive bailouts. I'll show you, though, the Japanese, what's happened in Japan. This is GDP, real GDP growth, which was very strong here in the Japanese economy until they hit the wall in 1992, and this was a massive real estate collapse. And the banks, the Japanese banks actually lent more money to the borrowers so they could meet their interest and principal payments. Yeah. Now, how's that for every? See, what the? Look, we'll get out of this recession and we'll grow back, okay? We'll grow back and we'll be able to pay all this stuff off. I'm sorry, that's the problem, okay? That's why they're stuck. And so in Japan, here is real government revenue, which is going right along here, and then it actually is flat or falling here over the last 20 years, two decades now. And here's government spending going up and up. Massive accumulation of debt and low anemic growth. Okay, and you know what else can we look at other than other experiments around the world to get some ideas? Because it's not part, we don't have in the U.S. A replication of this experience. Well, and then I'm going to briefly here look at charts for Finland, Thailand, and Argentina. And these are all cases where market depreciation of the currency, the currency eventually really, really tubed, and that generated recovery largely first through exports. Export markets started to really come back strong, in some cases imports also falling, and those economies started to recover. It was delayed in Thailand and Argentina because the authorities were trying to maintain the currency. All that did was kick the can down the road, okay? here's Finland. I'm sorry for such a busy chart, but these are measures. Here's GDP is the red line. All of these macro, here's consumption. Here, fixed investment, that includes housing and business investment and government expenditures. They're all plotted as a percentage of their first quarter level when the recession started. So we just kind of normalize on what these measures were We've done this on all the recessions in the book because it provides you kind of a nice way of getting seeing the relative importance and the changes that are going on. This kind of thing experimentalists do, okay? Well, here's this massive inflow of investment into housing and private business investment over these years, and the economy growing, and then it collapses. Okay, and here comes those. Government spending continues to rise. GDP is falling, and then what starts to happen then? Here's the number of market it takes to buy a U.S. dollar, and so they go from around 3.5 up to around 4.25 up in here, and then on up to 6. I mean, the market really depreciates. And here's now, Finland is largely running a small current account deficit. Now all of a sudden exports start to surge and imports flatten out. A lot of the exports have a fair amount of imports in them. So, you know, to really look at that, you've got to look at different firms and whether they're entirely domestic or not makes a difference. But anyway, it starts up and now GDP starts to recover in Finland. Here's a similar chart for Thailand. And here's everything initially measured relative to the first quarter of their recession. And here's the collapse in investment. Here's government spending continuing to rise, GDP falling. And here's, in Thailand, they're trying to prevent the currency from depreciation. Remember, this is another way of protecting incumbent investors. Okay, keep the ones that are involved in these investments that you're trying to protect from losses from the collapse of the currency. Well, they couldn't hold back the sea, and so the currency really goes up. And now back comes exports, and the economy starts to recover. And then it's a similar story in Argentina. Here's the long period where they're trying to hold the currency, and then he finally let it go, and here's a surge in exports relative to imports, and the Argentina economy comes back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Okay? And you have to figure out how to get out of it. I can't do it other than my methods are all painful.
This podcast has been brought to you by Texas A&M University's Division of Research. To learn more about the Texas A&M Institute of Advanced Study or listen to additional podcasts in this series, please visit tias.tamu.edu.